This is the Austin Road Show podcast. The Roads Rewind.
Doug Parker is a retired Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent. He served 30 years investigating over 250 deaths, armed robberies, sexual assaults, and child molestation cases. Other duties, the lighter side of his job, included providing protection for President Carter, President Clinton, Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, and other heads of states from foreign countries and celebrities when they visited Augusta, or excuse me, the Augusta area. And I guess you were stationed out of the office in Thompson?
Yes, sir.
And were you all 30 years there?
Yes, sir. 30
did I,
years.
Did I mention my father-in-law that I'm sure that you know?
Who's that?
Marcy Remsen.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Known Marcy for a long time. Good
fella. Pretty awesome dude, huh?
Yes, like him.
And he's kind of like you are. He retires from one job and then goes to another. And he can't stand to be out of law enforcement. So he's working right now for Tolliver County. You also are continuing to work, even though you're not officially wearing a state badge anymore. You're a private investigator.
And that's true, yes. Sir.
Security
do a lot of
consultant.
Consulting work on several different cases, companies.
The book that you have written is A Killer Plan, which is spelled K-I-L-L-H-E-R. It's a behind-the-scenes book concerning one of the most notorious murder investigations you worked on in your career. And tell everybody the story, Doug.
Well, it's probably not your true crime story book that you've probably read. I mean, this one not only talks about the crime itself, the murder that was precipitate on this young lady, but also other cases that I've worked are built into the book, along with my upbringing in law enforcement also. But, it details the case from the minute I was called out all the way to the final end of it, on ending in the prosecution.
Now, I'm trying to get the exact dates of all this. It happened in 1997.
May 1997, yes, sir.
And What was your first experience dealing with the murder? It's incredibly sad for so many different reasons, but Christia Anderson, whenever you're dealing with the death of a young woman, particularly under the circumstances that you discovered, I don't know how folks like you deal with this without going a little bit crazy. Do you compartmentalize well? Your lovely wife, I met her a little while ago. She seems quite normal and quite nice. And I say that because it takes a special kind of person to be married to a police officer. How long have you guys been married?
She'll tell me 37.
Bless your heart. I mean, it's like being married to a career military person who stays deployed constantly, except he does come home at night. But she's sitting in the next room. I'm looking over at her right now. I don't know how you do it, though. I get wrapped up in one of these cases about twice or three times a year, but I'm able to, you know, kind of divorce myself and walk away and do other things. This is what you have to deal with from the time you get up till the time you go to bed at night.
Yes, sir. I mean, you can't become attached to them, because I know one day we had, I believe, three or four bodies on the ground and a couple of different cases that we had to work, you know, everybody from the office. So, yeah, you're constantly dealing with deceased and working those types of investigations. Then with child molestations, robberies, and dealing all the with all the meanness in the world, yes, sir. Tough thing to do, but you just have to put it out of your mind.
I want to share what was written in the introduction here just real quick. During my 30-year career with the GBI, I realized not every case I investigated was worthy of documenting in book form. However, Christy Anderson's murder case was in the back of my mind as I was getting close to retirement. I would often think that this case could tell a story, especially to murder victims' families, of the many different phases of a murder investigation. And I want to say, this book, from my experience reading it over the course of the last several days, it ought to be a textbook for folks in, I'd call it cop shop, going through the academy. I mean, this is fascinating material.
Well, thank you. And I've also reached out to Georgia Southern, where I graduated from. I've talked to the Criminal Justice Department down there and others throughout the Southeast about hopefully making it at least a suggested reading to people that are wanting to take criminal justice courses, because it tells you about why we write search warrants, like in this case, how we set up a room to interview somebody, the many things that we're thinking. And, again, my wife dealing with being gone a lot, two or three days at a time. So, yes, it's kind of almost a how-to.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break a little bit early, because I'm going to get right into what happened when you got the call back in 1997 about Miss Anderson's death, and we'll follow through as to exactly what happened, how the case took some twists and turns, and what it took to bring the killer to justice. Doug Parker is a retired GBI agent. He is now working in private security endeavors as a PI and as a security consultant. He's written a book called A Killer Plan, Behind the Crime Scene Tape, and the majority of the book is dedicated to the murder investigation of Christina Anderson back in 1997. So what was your first call on the case? How did it come into your case file?
About 2 a.m. in the morning. I hadn't had enough sleep yet. Phone rang. Of course, that was before cell phones. Had to run to the hardline phone in the kitchen and got the call from the State Patrol saying that Burke County was requesting assistance in a death investigation. And so immediately got showered, dressed, and jumped in the car and headed on the drive down there below Waynesboro towards Midland.
To kind of explain to folks that don't understand it, the smaller departments, particularly back in 1997, Burke County not equipped to handle a complicated murder investigation.
Yeah, just as far as resources, yes, sir.
By the way, I know that they've come a long way in the last 20 years or so, particularly under Alfonso Williams in the last couple of years. If this event were to happen today, would you get that same phone call from Burke County?
Probably so. I think they still call on the major cases. Yes, sir.
On a murder case like that?
Yes, sir.
Whereas Columbia County and Richmond County have the resources to handle it themselves.
Correct. Yes, sir.
So you're called out. And by the way, you get these calls typically how often back in those days a year?
Well, back then it was only about six agents. And so we were handling call at least on a rotating basis, at least, you know, 1 week out of six that you're on call 24/7 for anything in 10 counties.
Just describe the crime scene as you pulled up to it that in the wee hours of that morning.
Yeah, saw Christina's car on the side of the road, still heading south towards Millen, parked perfectly parallel to the roadway.
And this is between Waynesboro and Millen?
Right, almost at the Jenkins County line.
Gotcha.
And, of course, she's still in the car, glass everywhere. There wasn't a piece of glass, I don't think, left in the side windows of her car. And several people standing around, some of her friends, husband, of course, EMTs, and other investigators from both counties, both Burke and Jenkins, because it was just a couple hundred feet from the Jenkins County line.
Mm. What was it about the case that immediately made you think that there was either something different or did you? Did you think this is a routine either assault or robbery case?
Yeah, well, we didn't know at the time. We have no information until we start talking to people to find it. And it's important to develop a timeline, you know, exactly when calls came in, when the husband was calling. So it was all we knew was we had a car that was shot up pretty bad. Couldn't tell if it was an automatic weapon or what was that had shot up the car.
Were the keys still in the car?
Car was in drive. Her foot was on the brake, and the car was running.
Was it in park?
No. And that's why I don't want to give away the whole story.
Right,
but
right, right.
Yeah, very interesting the way that car came to rest there.
So, again, when you get there, car is running, foot's on the brake. I mean, a natural movement in a dead body, which happens all the time, could have sent that car off into the woods.
Could have, and yeah. It would have made it worse for us to try to process the scene.
Yeah. So explain briefly without giving away too much of the story what you had to do.
Well, at that time, we had crime scene technicians. I mean, I came on when we didn't have technicians. I had to do all the processing myself, photographs, fingerprints, pouring plaster casts. And so the crime scene tech started processing the scene. And I'm talking to him along with trying to talk with witnesses on the side of the road, trying to find out information as to...
And no one had heard this, I don't think. Is that true?
Right.
They literally pulled up on it and saw it. That was your first report.
Some of the witnesses there were just people driving by that just had seen it or seen the
remnants of it.
Right, yes, sir.
2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
When you started doing the background interviews, how long did it take you to, again, I don't want to give away the whole story, and this is a fascinating case, but we'll sum it up like this. Her personal life comes into it, and you come to find out there's not only a husband that's kind of a nefarious character involved, but also at least $15,000 in money that shows up missing from some...
Right, yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, so this involves way more than just a ticked-off husband and wife.
Right. Money, girls, sure, yes, sir. All of us involved.
How old was Christine?
Ooh, probably mid-20s.
Mid-20s. And her mother, I know you got to know very well in handling of this case. One of the more heartbreaking aspects of this was the fact that she was completely devastated by the killing, as you can well imagine that she would be. And she was kind of by herself, wasn't she? And not much of a support group.
Well, her husband had passed away.
Right.
And so, yeah, there she was running a business. And like I explained in the book, you know, one day she's running her business and the next day she's burying her daughter. A very hard thing to do.
And she would, how, again, trying not to give away too much of the book. A lot of your strong leads came from her early on.
Sure did.
Yeah.
Talking with her, she had theories, and of course she's throwing out all these theories, and I'm just gathering information from her and asking her questions about lifestyle, what they did, what they liked, what they enjoyed, that type of thing.
How long had she been married to her husband?
I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years, guessing.
And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, how do we tell this, giving the story away? Anybody that knows this case knows what happened.
Sure,
as far as the eventual outcome of it goes. So let's get into it a little bit here. You obviously have the old adage that when somebody dies, what percentage of the case is something like 9 out of 10, the person that killed him knew him and knew him well?
Exactly.
And so is that why it's so difficult when there's somebody, you know, we're talking about Ted Bundy a little while ago, when you got a killer that's picking out random people, that completely throws your methodology out the window, and it puts you in a whole different mode, which is one of the reasons why serial killers are so hard to catch.
Right, because
if they're picking on people they don't know.
Right, because as investigators, you are starting from that center point and then moving out, just like I said, concentric circles. You start moving outward as you get into the investigation.
But you almost never move outside that 25-foot area of the house.
Right.
That's heartbreaking, but not surprising. In a case like this, how long was it before you were sitting in a room with her husband?
Probably within 6 or 7 hours.
So my son is a big Spider-Man fan, and he'll talk about Spidey sense every now and then, that little tingling that goes off. Most of the homicide investigators that I've known in my life have developed what they call a sixth sense about people that have been involved in serious crimes. Do you possess that same intuition? And by the way, your wife is laughing about this. I'm kind of wondering if you if you have a hard time getting away with telling him that you didn't eat the last hot dog or something. He wants to put you under the light and ask you directly, where's that donut that I left out last night? Is this something that comes naturally to you, or was it something that you had to hone over the years?
No, sir. I mean, I guess that was a learned behavior, and yes, but very, you can tell your son that is a, what'd you say, spider sense?
Spidey sense.
Spidey sense, yes, sir. Immediately, things start going off in your head. Because I do a lot of statement analysis, and when people say certain words, it ticks, you know, something goes off in my head and says, that wasn't quite right, you know, whether they use a certain word or whatever. So, yeah, start analyzing everything that people say, and it does ignite something in your head to start thinking a certain way.
Tell folks about Christia real quick. Give us a little bit of background about her.
Yeah, beautiful young lady that worked over in North Augusta, worked at the Walmart over there, very good worker. Everybody liked her, and what I learned from her sister and her mother was, you know, she didn't meet a stranger. And you can't say that, everybody. You can't say that about me. I'm not nice to everybody. But she was. I mean, she was just happy, smiling with everybody she met. And that was what was so great about her. And loved children, loved, you know, the children that she was around with other family members. And so she was. That was that type of person she was, just a great, wonderful person.
What was the background story with her and her husband?
Gotten married. He had he was a hard worker, but grew up into an area that, you know, instead of going off to school, he wanted to go to school, and I think took some college-level courses, but was a hard worker, worked 2 or 3 jobs, you know, trying to make a living for both of them. You know, did a fairly good job at certain points. Providing for both of them.
And they were living where exactly?
In Perkins.
In Perkins, which is, again, in Burke County.
Jenkins County. Right, okay. Across into the county.
With this case, again, kind of coming back to the family a little bit, how long did it take you to figure out that this husband had something to do with the case? Again, the spidey sense. Did it hit you immediately?
Immediately.
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 What did he do?
Well, I'm giving away the last page of the book.
And we want everybody to buy this book. I'm going to tell everybody where to go on the website.
Okay, but no, I mean, it was just the fact that I arrive and he's over there on the side of the road.
He is at the murder scene.
He is at the scene. He's the one that found her. Rule number one.
Okay.
So that was one thing. I'm always suspicious of whoever finds the person that's dead. And just his actions just set me off immediately.
His motivations check out in the book. That's also interesting when you get into that, too. But this guy was a bit of a weirdo. Well, in the way that he liked women.
Correct.
Okay. All right. We'll leave it at that. County line murder still compels investigator. Is it Richard Adams that wrote the article?
I believe so.
All right. Good job and nice picture of you out by the way station, which was one of the key pieces of the puzzle, so to speak.
Yes, there's a meeting spot where a couple of them got together and started talking about it, started hiring people.
And by the way, it was a convenience store, right? How would you describe the waste station?
The waste station was a beer joint.
Beer joint, okay, all right. And is it completely closed down now?
Yes, sir.
Is it empty?
Empty. I don't know. I haven't been inside.
I see you outside. It looks like something out of The Walking Dead, completely grown over. Kind of spooky when you revisit places like that.
Yes, sir. It's a little eerie.
And, let's get back to the forensics that you worked with in this case. And you started interviewing the husband of the deceased almost immediately. You know, this young, mid-20s young lady taken out in the prime of life. Was it obvious to you from the crime scene? Was the crime scene indicative of an acquaintance murder, or was it generic enough where it could have been an armed robbery? It could have been an assault gone wrong.
Well, we immediately ruled out armed robbery because of all the personal belongings in her car. But we didn't know if it was a gang shooting. I mean, with all the glass being gone, so many bullet holes riddled inside the car. You know, there were bullets found, door frames, dashboard. Steering wheel that didn't know what had happened, didn't know if it was a gang initiation. Somebody said, hey, you got to kill somebody, join a gang, or what it was.
And it was one weapon that you were eventually able to figure that out, right?
Or two.
Two weapons.
Yes, sir.
How many bullets did you recover?
It was probably 7, 8, 9, 10. Don't know exactly.
And so when you recover bullets at a crime scene like that, particularly given the fact that you come on the side of the road, chances are there are probably a number of bullets that went through the glass and landed out in the woods somewhere.
Right. Projectiles.
Yeah. Right. And so I'm sure you did a cursory look, but chances are there probably could have been more out there.
No, but we did seize some projectiles from the vehicle, so that was why it was important to try to find the guns that were used.
Absolutely. And again, in the process of interviewing the witnesses and particularly Miss Anderson's husband, how long did it take you to kind of piece together what you were dealing with here and understand that there was a lot more to the story than Anderson was willing to share with you in initial interviews?
Yeah, of course, immediately thought he was involved, but now we had to prove it, and it took a long time to finally gain all the evidence because we had to have guns to match to the – because we hadn't any shell casings. We just had the projectiles themselves, which we could still match to the barrels of the guns that were used if we had them.
What kind of guns ultimately did you determine were used?
357 and 9mm.
And would you have – again, off the top of your head, the kind of experience that you've had with these kinds of cases, is this a weapon that is typically used in a situation like this, or is it just whatever's handy?
Anything's typical in the shooting. I mean, we had 22s, you know, 380s, 38s, 357 didn't matter. I mean, but it was interesting we had two weapons, which is very important to an investigator. I mean, we like to have that. We like to have two weapons. We like to have two or three people involved. Helps us out on the case.
When you're dealing with a witness like this that obviously is the husband, he's going to be in charge, at least legally, of final arrangements and what happens to all of her personal belongings and all that. You're walking around with knowledge in your head and in your heart that she's got something to do with this case, or he's got something to do with this case. Is it difficult watching someone play the bereaved husband at that point?
If there was much bereavement at all, yes. He was in charge at the time because we didn't have anything on him. He wasn't there. So, you know, no physical evidence that could tie him to the scene at that time.
Where did he say he was when it happened?
He was at home.
And there was no one else there with him?
Correct. There were people there before, but no, he wasn't there at the scene. Mm. Did
the mother of the victim finger her son-in-law?
Yes, that was a concern. She threw that out there, along with other things. Again, you've got a parent that had her daughter one day, and now she's gone. And so you can imagine what's conjured up in her mind. What could have happened?
How long did it take you to piece together what you needed to take it to the DA and say, we've got enough information here, this guy needs to be charged?
Well, we had enough probable cause to make the arrest before we had all the physical evidence. But it took over a year and a half to get all the physical evidence,
How long until you made the probable cause arrest?
That was probably a couple of weeks.
Were you ever operating in this case under the fear that the guy was going to disappear?
Yeah, because, again, I want an airtight case with all the physical evidence. And so that would be the last nail in the coffin for him would be all of the evidence, which I'm talking about the weapons.
Right. Again, this is 1997, technology much different than it is now. How long did it take for you to, once you got the physical evidence that you needed, to get it processed through the crime lab?
We didn't end up processing everything because it ultimately ended up in guilty pleas. So, but we had ready for, I mean, we had some handwriting that we needed some analysis completed on that had submitted, but we're waiting to do that if need be, along with matching up the firearms. But we did have the at least the projectiles matched to the weapons once we had the weapons. That didn't take too awful long, just a couple of months to get that, but that wasn't that critical. Because we had statements from other people, we had the evidence at the scene, and eventually the weapons.
What was it about the demeanor of the husband that put him in your sights immediately as being someone involved?
Well, think about this: if your wife is laying dead 30 feet from you in a car, could the police hold you back? Probably not. I mean, you'd want to get to her. You'd show some emotion, and that was lacking.
I'm blown away that he would be stupid enough to be the one. He's laughing at me here. That he would be stupid enough to be the one to call the police and say.
Oh well, that was done for a reason. He's the caring husband. Hey, my wife's missing.
Well, missing is one thing. Right. Saying that you're the one that discovers her, that's a whole different thing.
Right.
I would think that most killers would want to be as far away and constructed as airtight an alibi as possible.
Well, I just think about other cases where people have found them, and don't want to mention names, but out in Colorado, who found the little girl in the house?
No doubt. That's one that. One of these days, somebody asked me one time, said, what are you going to be your first questions when you get to the pearly gates? Who killed JonBenet Ramsey? That's right at the top of the list. Again, the book is A Killer Plan. And by the way, let's give the website out real quick because it is featuring not only a way for you to buy the book, but also to see pictures of the crime scene and also the victim in the case and a few other items that were not included in the book as far as photographs go. What's the website?
Yes, www.akillherplan. And again, that's akillherplan.com.
And this book, again, will be signed at an upcoming signing. When is this?
Right, this Friday at Burke Perk, which was the old magistrate office for Judge Palmer, him and his wife. And then at High Rail Cafe the next week in Thompson.
In Thompson. The article that was written by Richard Adams is online at the Austin Roadshow page on Facebook. If you want to go link there through it, you'll be able to read a little background on the case. Any of the media folks still around that you were dealing with back in those days in Burke County?
Yeah, Sandy Hodson, she's still around.
Well, Sandy was with the Chronicle, though.
Right.
Somebody in Waynesboro, the folks you were dealing with.
Oh, no.
Because we were talking about some of the old folks that we knew back in the day. In McDuffie County, which was where the GBI office was based that you worked out of, Billy Hobbs.
Yeah, still stay in contact with him.
Yeah. We were talking, Doug and I were, about some other cases that he and I both are very, very familiar with. The Clifford Boutry case was a very, very odd case involving a young man who was wanted for the murder of a GBI agent. Did you know Bob?
Bob Bell? Kerr, yes, sir, worked with him. He was a trooper and then transferred right over to our office. So, yeah, met him the first day, well, even as a trooper, but, yes, worked in our office.
Boutry was a ne'er-do-well young man, I don't want to say 20, 21 years old.
Probably so, yes, sir.
And killed Kirk. While Kirk was questioning him at his residence, he saw Boutry out on the street, I believe, if memory serves.
Boutry came up to his house on the front porch and wanted a match, but didn't have a cigarette. And that's what sparked Bob's concern.
That is interesting. And did they ever figure out what Boutry was up to at that point?
Yeah. Well, later on, what it was is he was having an argument with a guy down the street that was doing security work at a plant down there. Because I guess there was some boyfriend-girlfriend mixing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he was wanting a match to, I think, burn something.
And he just asked the wrong guy.
Asked the wrong person.
And at some point, Kirk apparently identified himself as a police officer.
Went down there while the two were arguing, saw that Boutry had something in his waistline. Boutry ran off. Bob chased him. Boucher turned around, shot him in the stomach, and then shot him in the head as he laid on the ground.
And this was something that was a complete and total chance encounter.
Yes.
How long did you work with Bob?
Oh, I guess he was there for a couple of years before he was shot.
So he was in his mid-30s?
Yes, sir.
I guess it was. For this to have happened, it turned the city upside down, the entire region upside down. Boutry was taken into custody by the Thompson City Police Department?
Yes, sir.
And escaped within a day or two and was on the lam for a couple of weeks. He eventually was spotted walking in the center of downtown Thompson with a shotgun in his hand that had been provided to him by some folks that were helping him out. And
sawed-off shotgun.
And when he was confronted by a law enforcement officer who ran across him, again, in the middle of the city, it was about 8 o'clock at night, I think.
Yes, in the evening.
It was twilight. He wheeled around with the gun leveled at the officer, and the officer shot him, killed him on the scene. Within a day or two of that happening, I was working here as a radio reporter at WGAC. Greg Patton, the late great Greg Patton, whose picture's right outside this door, as a matter of fact, he and I went up to Thompson to ask questions. Various folks interviewed various people. And while I was standing right where Boutry was shot, this little 8-year-old kid rode by on a bicycle. And he kept riding by and looking at me and what I was doing. And I said, "Did you know this young man?" He said, "Yep, sure did. And I know where he was." I said, "What do you mean you knew where he was?" He said, "I know where he was hiding. Because his cousin was taking him hamburgers, and I was helping get the hamburgers for him in the bags." And I said, "Don't you think?" And I don't know. The kid, I don't know. He didn't think I was a cop, because I certainly wasn't dressed like a cop. I don't know who he thought I was. I don't think he had any idea I was a reporter. And I said, "Can you show me where he was?" And he said, "Yep, it's right there." And he pointed to a window in an old bottling plant that you literally could look out the window where he was sitting and see the spot that Boutry was shot and killed. And so I looked around. I was looking for a cop. I was like, "I got to tell somebody." But then I said, "This kid might just be yanking my chain." I said, "Can you take me up there?" And he said, "Yeah." And we get about halfway there, and he says, "I don't know if I can do this. I'm probably getting in trouble." And I had to bribe him to do it. Gave him a $10 bill is all I had in my pocket. I said, "I give you $10. "Okay, okay." So we went up there, and he showed me the steps leading up there. And again, this is a dilapidated, falling apart bottling plant. And he pointed me to a room, and again, with a window. And there were fast food bags all over the place and dirty magazines and a bedroll and a couple of pop bottles. And he told me that Clifford would look for the cops looking for him, searching the city. And I said, "Why didn't they come in here?" And he said, "They did, but he had a hiding place. And he also had somebody that was up there with him that I guess was a bum that was kind of like giving cover, like, yeah, this is where I am." So in other words, they had no idea Boutry was there with him. And I'm writing all this stuff down and getting one kind of interviews that I can. And finally, Greg was able to flag down an officer in about 2 minutes. That place was cordoned off. And won an award for that story. Doug Parker is a retired GBI agent. He has written a book, A Killer Plan. Kill Her Plan, K-I-L-L-H-E-R Plan, behind the crime scene tape. And again, give the website, Doug.
www.akillherplan.com.
And there's an article that the True Citizen has put out just today on this book and Doug's book, and it's, excuse me, on this case in Doug's book, and it's at the Austin Roadshow page on Facebook. You can link to it through there. We were talking about some other cases that he has worked that I've known about in the past, including the infamous, and I say that in a good way because it was, thank God in heaven, ended up with a happy ending, the Food Lion Columbia County Master's Week case of, was that 94?
Ooh, you're asking me a date again.
I don't remember what year it was. But the GBI had to handle it because Columbia County Sheriff's deputies ended up killing two gunmen
right.
that were in the process of robbing the Food Lion. One of the deputies was a veteran deputy that had been on the job a long time. The other deputy had been on the job 2 weeks, and he was kind of undergoing his, not probation, but it was a training period. What do they call that? It was a training period?
Yeah, just on-the-job training.
They ended up dispatching both bad guys. The deputy that was undergoing his training is Scott Johnson, who's now the Columbia County Administrator. And those guys with the shotguns and the Food Lion had no earthly idea they were being bared down on by Columbia County officers. And what was left of them, there wasn't much left of them, because I believe the cop that shot the bad guys got them with shotguns, if I'm not mistaken.
I think shotgun at 223.
Oh, that's right. First of all, a point of clarification. We were talking about that horrific Food Lion shootout back in the late 80s involving late Columbia County Deputy Frank Brown and Scott Johnson, who was a trainee at the time. Also along and as part of the team was Gary Jones, who's now the mayor of Grovetown, of course. And I was trying to remember who played what role as far as the shootings go, because there was one deputy that used a shotgun and the other that used a handgun. Or was it a rifle? Do you remember?
223.
Which is 223?
Right.
A rifle.
Right, correct.
Okay, so I want to make sure I got that right. So it was Gary Jones that actually used the shotgun.
Oh, okay.
Brown had the 223.
I can remember who had what. But
and it was quite a mess.
It was.
Doug Parker's got a book signing coming up. Not quite as exciting as the Miller Theater, but almost.
No, but I wouldn't mind the Miller. That's a nice place.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I love it.
Your book signing in Burke County is coming up when?
Right, Burke Perk, Friday from 11 to 2, which is the old Palmer Hardware store in Waynesboro.
And then you've got one more after that?
Yes, at High Rail Cafe in Thompson. I believe that's on the 23rd. Yes, from 4 to 6.
Has anyone ever approached you with the notion or the idea that your life story would make either a fun movie or a TV show? Because, you know, we've seen CSI in New Orleans. We've seen them in New York. We've seen them in L.A. I don't know that we've ever seen one in rural America. And that's been your backyard.
Right, in the South.
Yeah.
In Georgia. I'd love to see that.
And you actually were featured in a couple of the cases that you've handled on the, was it
the ID Channel? Murders? Yeah, Swamp Murders.
Swamp Murders.
Right.
I think Bob Young's worked with those folks as an extra a couple of
Has
times.
Has he? I didn't know that.
And you've been featured on that show before.
That's correct. They ran one show about the investigation up in Thompson.
If you out there in Radio Land have something you would like to ask this career law enforcement agent who, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, I say unfortunately, he's retired. He's no longer actively chasing the bad guys around out there. But as a private investigator, you do your own share of that.
Oh, yeah. We still work with families that had, a loved one dies. We do several representations of officer-involved shootings, representing them through attorneys when they're sued or when they're charged with crimes.
You were talking a little while ago about the polygraph tests that were involved in this murder that the book is based on.
Right.
That technology has come a long way in the last 20 years or so.
It has.
Are you a certified polygraph?
Oh, no, sir. We had David Rush was a polygraph operator in the office that did that.
But with the technology improving over the last several years, have people gotten better at catching the people, catching the sociopaths? One of the reasons that this book is so intriguing is that you've got a killer who seems to know how to manipulate the system pretty well.
Right.
And it seems like the technology these days has made that type of con artist a little bit more difficult to get away with things.
It has, I'm sure, with the technology. They're able to, the machines, I'm sure, are more sensitive, computer operated now, and can detect a lot, detect things a little bit better.
All right, 706-863-5800. Robin in North Augusta has a question for former agent Doug Parker.
Hey, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I'm enjoying your interview here. Doug, are you the one who plays the organ at the Cultural Center for the Silent Movie Night?
No, sir, I'm not. But I do play. I hack at a guitar.
Wow, where did you? Is it someone with the same name, Doug Parker?
Evidently.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry
thank
about you, that, sir. Robin. Of all that, wow, you got a guy here that's dealt with blood, guts, multiple killings, horrible smells in the morgue office, and they ask you about playing the organ at the silent movie. It's kind of funny.
Funny, yeah.
Real quick, I made mention a little while ago of your career as a private investigator. I've had the opportunity to get to know several PIs over my career, and none of them ever want to sit down for an interview. Because they don't want to talk about any cases that they've ever had.
I wouldn't either.
But and that I understand. But when it comes to methodology and when it comes to the types of cases that you handle, do me a favor. Over the course of the next several weeks, just in the back of your mind, kind of sketch together some cases that we could talk about. I'd love to have you back and talk about the kinds of things that a PI is asked to do. It's fascinating in a lot of ways. I've seen it up close and personal because I've actually been interviewed by private investigators on, geez, probably half a dozen different occasions on cases involving everything from the Charles Walker scandal that I helped turn over some evidence in up to, character interviews or character studies on people that were associated with notorious crimes. The Mike Howell murder case comes to mind. He was a former sports editor here at the Columbia County News-Times who was unfortunately murdered by his own daughter. But it's fascinating in that private investigators these days are plugged in from everything from serious murder cases down to daddy mama cases. Or baby mama case, excuse me.
Right.
Trying to figure out where Julio went.
The whole gamut.
And isn't it fascinating that in this day and age, with technology being what it is, that there are still people who think they can run and hide from the authorities?
I'm not really amazed, and I'm still amazed. So it's, yes, or both ways. That they try to circumvent that and usually catches them.
With the exception of disappearing into the wilderness, there's almost no way that a human being can successfully disappear on their own these days. Not like it used to be 30, 40 years ago.
Very hard because, you know, any major city, you can probably pull, 10, 15 stores that have video that are out on the streets. You can track somebody's movement.
And now private residences have them.
Right,
all over the
sure.
Place. All right, Jimmy and Augusta online, too. Get your earphones back on there. Jimmy, you're up. Go for it.
You know, I was going to ask the guy this. You know, this black man in Texas that says his 4-year-old granddaughter was a duck and he got hit in the head and blacked out for 24 hours. Oh, that story just don't sound right to me. Does that sound right to you?
Anytime I hear that somebody blacked out and can't remember, yes, sir, I'm always suspicious.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure they'll find out. I don't know what he'd done or what happened. But anyway, I was going to ask you, you know, people are getting out of prison on DNA and they're going to prison on DNA. What kind of percentage you think DNA is? Based on your opinion of it or working with it.
You mean how reliable is it?
Yeah, because they're having a lot of problems with it. People saying in court that it's not reliable, and then certain people are weighing that in. And then you have, it's good, 40-year case. It's cold case.
That's a good question. Jimmy, I had not heard that anyone's questioning, and thanks for the question, the validity of DNA integrity. I mean, that's interesting.
I think people attack the way probably was collected for cross-contamination, and there are some issues there. But as far as the probability that somebody did it through the because of the DNA testing, I mean, the numbers are almost astronomical. I mean, it's still a percentage. When I had the crime lab report, it would say one in however many thousands and hundreds of millions or a identical twin.
How many years ago did you retire?
Six or seven.
Were you working with the GBI crime lab guy that helped Ashley Pletcher solve that cold case involving the elderly woman that was murdered? And for 20 years, no one knew who did it. She was sexually assaulted as well. And there was DNA collected at the scene that was untested. Well, it was the sample wasn't worthy, test worthy at the time. Technology was able to technology developed over the course of the ensuing years, and they were able to finally put together that a neighbor had been responsible for that death, and his name just went right out of my head.
I didn't work on that one. So
okay, all right. It was a fascinating. That was the case that Richard Roundtree was involved in, and that he had left the case file in his apartment and left to go to Quantico when he had moved out.
Yes, sir.
And thank God in heaven they put the case file back. It could have been thrown in the trash can. But Pletcher, Ashley Pletcher, who's now working out in Lincoln County, if she's still out there, I think, helped with the crime scene investigator with the GBI. And like I said, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name. They were able to get the suspect named in that case. How many cases do you think, if you had to give a conservative estimate, in the state of Georgia alone are sitting in boxes in the GBI annals and actually other departments as well, waiting for DNA tests to be done to clear up?
Ooh, couldn't give you a number, but I'm sure a fairly significant amount because we hold on to every piece of DNA evidence on a homicide for 10 years, and I think the law just recently changed.
Now it's permanent.
Yes, permanent.
Yeah, I was going to say, did they ever purge cases that are still open?
Yes, sir, and I went up, well, closed cases. I went just to Atlanta one day and went through several days of going through cases, yes, sir. So we closed out ones, but anything to do with DNA evidence was held.
But any case where you have never had a definitive solution, all of that evidence, no matter how old that case is, still exists somewhere.
Still exists. We have open cases still in the GBI, yes, sir.
And I've been told that DNA samples, if you've got a good enough blood sample or a tissue sample, that you can use DNA identification technology going back almost indefinitely, depending on the condition of the sample. In other words, if you've got a blood sample that was even collected as long ago as 1900, as long as it was kept in a dry, warm place, that it should be okay.
Should be, yes, sir.
Testing. That's crazy. Tony and Deering, and then we got to take a break here. Tony, you're on the air with Agent Parker.
Yeah, I just had a question. Years ago, there was a murder in Deering. A sweet little old lady got hacked to death with a machete by a guy that, from what I understood, he had carjacked a car in, like, New Jersey and killed that person and carjacked another one, ended up in Deering. I wondered if the gentleman knew anything about that case.
Yes, sir, our office worked that one. Yes, he was. He was passing through it. Actually stopped in Deering, killed this lady on her front porch, and then was captured later on up the road, I believe, which you mentioned, Pennsylvania, up in the northern state. Yes, sir.
Yeah, did he ever get prosecuted here, or did, you know, everything, you know, it happened?
Yes, sir, I believe he was extradited back down here to face the charges. Don't know the outcome. Yes, sir.
I was just curious about
you don't,
that.
You don't remember the name of the victim in that case, do you?
I do. I had met the lady actually about a week before that, went to work on a space heater of hers, and she's just a sweet lady. And then just, you know, I came home into town, and I see GBI and FBI and everything all over the place.
All right. Well, I'm sorry that we don't have a little more definitive information on it, but thank you for the call.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
There's a website before we go to news break here. I know this sounds very morbid, but it's an incredible website. Murderpedia. Do you know it?
No, sir.
It's got every publicized murder case that you can imagine in the country, as long as there's an arrest that goes with it. The caller a little while ago from Deering that wanted to know about the murder that happened. What year was that, Doug? Do you remember?
I'll have to ask the guy who sent me.
I've got it right here in front of me. Actually, it's 2001. And the killing itself may have actually happened in 2000. 38-year-old Eric Jerome Font, F-A-N-T, sentenced to life in prison for the murder of a 50-year-old woman man. He was a gas station attendant at a gas station in Snowshoe, Pennsylvania. He was sentenced to life in prison for that murder. He ended up cooperating with the authorities when it came to discussing other killings that he had participated in, and apparently he was a crazy lunatic who just went from place to place killing people with a machete. And included on that list, sadly, was 65-year-old Dorothy Street, dying from severe injuries to the head and neck. He was never prosecuted for that case down here because he pled out to the ones in Pennsylvania. And how often does that happen? That's routine. They'll put a note on a case file that says, you know, defendant pled guilty and admitted his responsibility for this crime, but he's being held without parole in Pennsylvania, so we kind of let it go.
Yeah, and once he received the life sentence up there, no need to bring him back down here.
What was your service weapon of choice? Did they give you a choice?
They issued, when I first came, it was a .357. Then we went to a 9mm and then to a Glock, and I think they're back to a 9 now.
Really? That's interesting. Do they go with that because of the number of rounds you can carry in the...
Not so much to have a knockdown power. They look at several different things, how functional...
What's any better than a .357? I'm asking.
Yeah, the .357 was such... I remember, when I first came on, that was a huge gun. And it would...
That's what I have.
You go through six rounds of that, and it's your hand's hurting.
You can stop a truck coming at you
if you
know where to shoot it with a .357. Do you remember Clint Eastwood and Dirty Harry movies giving... So, why do you use the .44? Well, .38 I've seen careen off a windshield. 9mm is a fine weapon, but if you're going to go for it, go for it. .44 will stop it. You just don't have a jacket that big to carry that thing,
right.
Unless you're Clint Eastwood, of course. But by the way, the reason I was asking you that, you ever been over to our friends at Southeastern Armory?
Yes, sir.
They've got a great shop, and even Doug Parker knows that. Our friends at Southeastern Armory invite you to get over there and check out their incredible line of up-to-date weaponry. We're talking about newly released weapons that come in every single month from the top manufacturers in the world, plus antique and vintage firearms that will amaze and impress you. And we're talking about weapons that go back decades and in some cases centuries. One-stop shopping for the gun enthusiast, both modern and up-to-date models, plus the antique, hard-to-find collectible weapons, all under one roof at Southeastern Armory, Washington Road at Alexander Drive, online, southeasternarmory.com. I win the award for the segue into a commercial right there.
I love going there. It's great.
Absolutely. He'll tell you that in a heartbeat. By the way, how often do you, when you were investigating crimes from all over the state of Georgia, did you find unusual weaponry used? Not necessarily a firearm, but I had a friend of mine that sent me a note a little while ago wanting to know if you had ever investigated a crime with a sword.
Not with a sword, but the one with the machete and...
I guess that would have been Miss Streets. That's
right.
Awful, yeah.
And then people use all kind of things. I've seen baseball bats and just sticks and rocks and just anything, heat of passion, somebody grabs something and kills somebody with it.
Yeah. What is it that separates a human being that's capable of planning and killing someone versus the normal human being? Have you ever thought about that much in your work?
Well, I do see, like I just mentioned, I do see a person that just gets mad at a card game, pulls out a gun, shoots somebody.
And I'm not going to say that's understandable, but that's something that you can kind of see
that.
Especially if alcohol or drugs are involved.
Right.
But someone that sits down and contemplates killing a man or a woman that they once loved, or God forbid their own child, or God forbid their own parent, how in the world, what is it, what level, everybody that has ever even considered a plan like that has to be considered mentally ill at some point, but not psychotic to the point they're not living in reality.
Well, just like he did in this case, he had several plans. Was going to try to use a tire iron or a piece of metal, beat her when she came home, burn up a car. The guy's thinking of all different kinds of ways to get rid of her.
And he's alluding to this story that you really need to read without getting too much into the ins and outs of the whys and the wherefores. How long did it take you to put together the complete story as to why Anderson would do this to his wife?
Well, like I said, it took a year and a half just to go to 2 years to go to complete prosecution to gather everything. But learning about what his plan was and the things, the extent that he went to talk to other people, to hire other people.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's maddening that there are enough people in the world that you could even turn around and have a conversation like that with that wouldn't immediately turn you in. But he was known for dealing with some pretty rough characters.
He was.
Yeah. By the way, the website again?
www.akillherplan.com.
All right. Let's get a phone call in. David in Evans. You're on the air with... Doug Parker, go ahead.
Mr. Parker.
Yes, sir, Dave.
I just wondered, were you involved in any way, or at least familiar with the Terry Grinstead disappearance?
Yes, I know the agent that worked the case. Talked to him on Terry Grinstead.
I got you.
Recently just came to prosecution on that case. I believe the guys were convicted. But, I knew Gary Rothwell. He was the guy, the case agent on that. and pretty extensive investigation into that one.
That was the teacher in Ocilla, Georgia, right, who disappeared in 2005, ended up being killed by a former student of hers.
Correct.
Yeah.
And they burned her body over a matter of days.
They what?
They burned her body over a matter of days.
Oh, I don't know if it was burned. I know she was buried.
Yeah, well, they ended up disposing of the body later on in a fire pit. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
David. John and Evans, you're on the air with Doug Parker. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Quick question. I'm new to Georgia, just moved down here. And so with your experiences across all these cases, what's the best way to not get murdered down here in Georgia? Kind of, we always watch the horror movies, and you're like, never run upstairs, never do this or that. So What's kind of your like top list of things to not do? Yeah.
According to the movies I've watched, don't ever have sex with a babysitter. Don't go camping anywhere near Friday the 13th, and hide under the bed on Halloween. But here's the odd thing, John, and thanks for the question because you kind of set me up here a little bit. What percentage of cases, we mentioned this a little earlier, does the killer have an intimate relationship with the victim?
Yeah, I'd say anywhere from 75% to 85%.
75% to 85%. And when I say intimate, that doesn't mean just having a romantic relationship or even being married to him. That means brother, sister, good friend, lifelong friend.
Right, good neighbor. Right, all those people.
It's unbelievable the level of misbehavior and mistreatment that people will put up with. There was a posting on Facebook a little earlier today about that case. Is it in Thompson right now where the woman ran over her husband, or was it in, I want to say it was in Thompson?
I don't know, Gant case? I believe so. I just talked to saw the chief today.
Okay, and so many members of her family have come forward and said this woman was tortured by this man for decades, and I'm like, where the hell were you? You know, a man would put his hands on my mother once, and then you'd be interviewing me about, geez, Austin, why'd you kill the guy? And I'd be telling you about it. I don't understand that. What is it about the world in general where we hear about these horrible things going on and we're reluctant to do anything about it?
Yeah, sad, because the cases that we have worked on murders, say if it was a female by the husband, we start looking back and there were so many times that it was reported. So many, you know, run-ins with the police, call-outs to their house. Sad to see that it progressed to someone's death.
And these killers are empowered by the lack of community response to their bad behavior. I just, in this day, particularly in this day of, you know, Me Too and all this, that, and the other, it seems like there would be a far more aggressive instinct among all of us to immediately act on this stuff.
Well, if it's not done right in front of them, I guess it's passed off as, you know, I didn't see it. I don't know what's going on.
You got two daughters?
Yes, sir.
How long would it take you? I mean, if daddy, he hurt me. It's all over with.
Yeah, they didn't like me talking to their boyfriends.
I can imagine. You ever cleaning the gun when the
no, guy's didn't clean the gun, but they knew
to pick up the
they knew
straight out of the Brian Kemp commercial there. Ed and Aiken, you're on the air with Doug Parker. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I had a question for Mr. Parker.
Yes, sir.
You all have an occasion to work with the late Bobby Posey, Chief Deputy in Burke County.
Bobby Posey?
Yes.
Oh, yes, sir. Knew him when I first came on in 84.
Good.
And
good.
Enjoyed working with him.
Well, I heard he was a fine law enforcement officer. He was my cousin, and I just wondered, it's kind of curious, and I was interested in all you were talking about today. I plan to read your book. So I just wanted to know if you knew him.
Yes, sir. Been on many search warrants with him.
Well, good deal. That's good to know. I know he told us a lot of stories. He was a few years older than me when he passed, but he would share some things with us. Some of them were funny, but some weren't. So enjoyed spending time with him.
Well, you had a good one. You had a good one.
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry for your loss. Hang in there. All right. Great conversation with Doug Parker. I want you to come back when you have the opportunity to get into the nuts and bolts of the private investigator game, if you're willing to do that.
Yes, sir.
The name of the book is A Kill Her Plan. You can check it out online, and it's akillherplan.com.
Correct.
And I want to mention your book signings one more time.
Yes, sir. Friday, Burke Perk, 11 to 2 in Waynesboro.
And that's May 10th.
Right, and then the 20th.
I mentioned this in case we replay it again. Go ahead.
And the 23rd at High Rail Restaurant in Thompson.
The True Citizen has written a good article on the book, and Doug himself, it's posted online at the Austin Roadshow page on Facebook. The unsolved cases that you've had to deal with in your career, I know that they have a way of getting under the skin of good investigators. Virtually any homicide investigator can rattle off at least a couple of cases that have left him perplexed and troubled. What's your most troubling case?
Tiffany Nelson. Went missing in Richmond County, found her body in Burke County. Little sweet young lady, little girl on a bicycle, and still unsolved today.
Was she strangled?
I don't want to get into details of how she
They've never revealed
right,
that.
Right.
I didn't know that. Okay, interesting. And she was a little black girl with pigtails,
right,
if I remember correctly.
Yes, sir.
And the Jeremy Grice story is one that got me too. You remember him?
No, sir.
He was a little boy that disappeared outside of a trailer in the mid-80s. Mm. And there was no trace of him ever found anywhere. The Tiffany Nelson case, is that the one where she actually had a sister or a parent attempt to revive the case recently?
Possibly so, yes, sir. Grandmother's very involved with it, and talked to her, and she was another one of those, like Mrs. Kerr, Christia's mom, that, boy, your heart just
Was there evidence recovered in that case that one day may be able to help solve it, given the advances in technology?
I hope so, yes, sir. I'm hopefully that it's going to be looked at through some DNA testing on that also.
Wonderful. That's great news. We did not know about that, so that's something we can consider as a bit of positive news. In a situation like this involving the death of Miss Anderson, about the best you can hope for is that justice will prevail and the responsible parties will be brought to account. And you did that, Doug, you and your team and all the people that worked on the case.
Well, it wasn't just me. I mean, we had a lot of agents worked on this case. I was just merely putting the case file together, so, and interviewing people, as did others.
His eventual sentence was life.
Without possibility of parole. Right.
And I can only hope that every single day of that man's existence is spent regretting what he did. Do you think that's a better sentence for someone than the death penalty?
I sometimes do, because of what they have to endure in a prison. I've been in many of them.
And Anderson didn't grow up as a thug. He didn't grow up as somebody that, you know, was necessarily daring the world to throw him in jail. So he's somebody that's actually feeling that every day.
He is. Thank goodness he's feeling it.
Mm. Did you ever hear from any people that believed that he was either not being treated fairly or was being framed early on in the investigation?
Well,
kind of played out.
Well, he made that claim himself.
Did he have anybody that backed him up?
No, sir.
That's pretty interesting. Doug, it's an honor to meet you, sir.
Hey, thank you. A pleasure.
A killherplan.com online.